Hello, lovelies. I'm Valeria, and this is Have Murder, Will Travel. What up, guys? Another week, another exciting episode. Where to this week? We're leaving the cold of Finland and heading south. We're going to South Africa. Back to Africa. That is a great... Sorry. Wow. I'm going to give you guys all a little window into how my non sequitur brain works. When I said back to Africa, I almost started to say, oh, that's a good movie. But then I realized that I was thinking of Out of Africa as being a good movie. But then as my brain thought of Out of Africa, I was actually picturing the African Queen with Bogey and Hepburn. And my brain did all of that in like 3 seconds. So yeah, I like trailed off. It was, robot me was broken. It's okay. There was a glitch, an early glitch. We're good now. We're good. Let's dive in now that I've bored you with how my brain works. So like I said, South Africa, here we come. We are going to be talking about Stuart Wilkin. Stuart Wilkin was a serial killer, pedophile, rapist, necrophiliac, and cannibal. So basically, a great guy. I don't know about you, but just on that opening description, I feel like I already know all I need to know about him. I don't like any of it. Fair warning, this one's going to be a little longer than any I've done before. Normally, I'll have about 4 or 5 pages of notes per episode. And for this episode, I have 14 pages of notes. So yeah, this one's going to be quite a trip. I didn't plan for a multi-parter because I'm not really sure where I would split it. So I'm just going to power through and you can listen to it in pieces. I mean, that's totally your right. Or listen it all at once. Get ready. I also want to give you guys all some warning that this case involves a lot of horrible things happening to children. Many of his victims were children, and I will be talking about some of the terrible things he did. I'm also going to be talking about the horrible things that happened to him as a child. So if you'd rather not hear a child case or hear about horrible things happening to children, you'll probably want to skip this episode. If you're still here, strap in. This one's a fucking doozy. Before we really dive in, I do want to give you a little background on South Africa. From the late 40s into the mid-90s, South Africa had apartheid. Apartheid is basically segregation. The white people were not the majority in South Africa, and yet they had all the power. The laws and customs split the population into 4 main groups. There were whites, Indians, colored, and blacks. That's not me coming up with those labels. That was legally what it was. The whites were the white people. They had the highest status in society, got all the best shit, got away with everything, had the most rights. Next were the Indians. Those, of course, are people from India or descended from people from India. And they were second in the hierarchy of society. The next group was called the Coloreds, and that was anybody who was multiracial. So it didn't matter what races they encompassed. So it didn't matter what multiracial makeup you were. If you were multiple races, you were considered colored and you were near the bottom of society. They were the third in the sort of hierarchy. And then the fourth group was called the blacks, and those were the black people, obviously. They were the lowest level of society. They basically had no rights. It was disgusting. I'm telling you this because Stuart Wilkin's crimes occurred from 1990 to 1997, So mostly during apartheid, Stuart Wilkin is white, and a number of his victims were not. I don't know for sure that racism played a role in the way these crimes were investigated, but given the racial power imbalances at play, a lot of articles I read, most people do think that race played a factor, like maybe the crimes weren't investigated as much as they would have been if the victims had been white. One thing I read even said that in South Africa during this time, if a victim was white, they took crime scene photos in color, and victims of other race, they used a black and white camera because color film was more expensive, and I guess only the white victims were worth that, which is fucked up as shit. But I'm just giving you a little background. That's the environment that this guy's operating in. Honestly, the fact that this existed at all is disgusting, but the fact that it existed all the way into the 90s is fucking ridiculous. Like, this was happening near the end of the 20th century because a bunch of racist, ignorant fucks were in charge. Anyway, I will get off my soapbox, dive into Mr. Stuart Wilkin. The baby that would become Stuart Wilkin is believed to have been born on November 11th, 1966. That is the birth date he was given when he was adopted, but we don't know for sure if it's accurate, but that's what we're going with. Stuart Wilkin was not his birth name. We don't actually know what his birth name was. You're going to see that this man had a horrendous childhood. Like anything you're imagining, I guarantee you, Stuart Wilkin's first few years are worse. When Stuart was just 6 months old and his sister was around two or three, they were found abandoned in a phone booth. They were found by a domestic worker who took them to her employer's home. Can you imagine? You're out walking, running some errands, going to the store, whatever, and you just find two kids in a phone booth. The fuck? I wouldn't know what to do. I would have been like, oh, fuck, I should not have gotten out of bed this morning. So the worker finds them in this phone booth and takes them back to her employer's house. The employer, a man we know only as Dope, is a gigantic piece of shit. Like, gigantic piece of shit doesn't even come close to covering it. This guy is honestly worse than some of the killers we've talked about on the podcast. The things he did to this baby are unfathomable. I'm just warning you, what you're about to hear is super, super fucked. Dup would burn Stuart's genitals with cigarettes. He used to put his food in a dog bowl and made him eat on the floor with the dogs. And remember, Stuart was only 6 months old when he first went to live with this man. Dup apparently would also engage in bestiality with the dogs, and he would make Stuart watch this. When Dup finished with the dogs, he would make baby Stuart lick his penis. This went on for a year and a half. This man did these things to a baby, a genuine baby. And he did these things for a year and a half. I want to puke just thinking about it. Ooh. At some point while Stuart was with Dup, his sister disappeared and he didn't know what happened to her. When I first started researching this case, I assumed the sister was dead, but spoiler alert, she's not. Just letting you know. Another thing I was thinking when I was first reading about this case was honestly kind of wondering about these abuses and Stuart's report of this. Like I was kind of doubting him a little bit because one, they're just so unfathomable. I was really hoping they were not real. Another thing that made me skeptical is the fact that Stuart was so young, and most people don't have memories from when they were that young. So I'm going to admit, I was a little skeptical when I first read these things. I thought maybe he was just trying to gain a little sympathy. Unfortunately, it seems these abuses were real and he did actually suffer from them because these abuses were confirmed by Stuart's adopted mother. We can absolutely have all the sympathy in the world for baby Stuart right now. What happened to him is disgusting, and at this point, he's nothing more than a poor, innocent victim. Now, I'm not saying that that condones or excuses any of his future behavior. I do think that these abuses definitely played a factor in his psychological development and maybe related to how he picks his victims and why he does what he does. We'll be discussing some of that a little later. But again, I'm not excusing anything he does as an adult when he's a killer. But the things that are happening to him right now, I do feel horrible about them and for him. I said the abuses occurred for a year and a half. What happened when Stuart was two? Dup died a slow, horrible death. Just kidding. But wouldn't that have been nice? Nope. I don't know what actually happened to Dup, but I do hope he died a slow, agonizing death for what he did to this baby. When Stuart was two, Dup's neighbors, Mr. and Mrs. Wilkin, decided to adopt him out of pity. They're the ones that named him Stuart. And honestly, the fact that he didn't even have a name up to this point just makes what's happening to him even worse. I don't know why. It just does to me. This poor, poor baby. And this is, like I said, Mrs. Wilkin later did confirm the abuses that Dup had subjected Stuart to. So that's why we know that these horrible things did actually happen to him. When the Wilkins took Stuart in, he was malnourished and infected with lice. Based on what he'd been going through, I feel like lice and nutrition are the least of his issues, and I'm surprised there weren't a lot of other things wrong with him. Now, in order for the Wilkins to officially adopt him, they needed permission from his biological mother. Stuart later said he remembered a woman coming to the house when he was about three. She gave him some candy and seemed nice, but that was all he remembered about her. That woman was Stuart's biological mother, and she was there to sign off on the Wilkins adopting him. Shortly after that, the Wilkins moved to Port Elizabeth. The town is known as PE, so that's how I'm going to be referring to it for the rest of the episode. P.E. means Port Elizabeth. Well, big fucking shock. This severely abused baby did not do well in school, academically or socially. I mean, is anybody really surprised by this? This baby would have needed some serious fucking therapy. But this was the early 70s in South Africa, so I don't know the state of mental health treatment, but I imagine it wasn't great. So yeah. He's not doing very well in school. He actually failed grade one. When he failed grade one, Mrs. Wilkin just thought it was because he wasn't trying and wasn't doing anything, so she withheld his Christmas presents as punishment for failing. So because of this, Stuart vowed to never try in school again. I just want to say, I'm not a parent, but I don't think withholding Christmas gifts is the best response to this situation. I feel like they should have maybe found out why he failed. Maybe he just needed a tutor. Because, I mean, you're going to see this guy's not stupid. Like, he's smart in a scary way. Like, he's maliciously intelligent. Evil intelligence. I don't like it. He did finally pass grade one. I guess he didn't have any problems in grade two because I didn't see anything about that. But then he failed grade three times. He also said that he was mocked by his classmates. Apparently they would make fun of him for being adopted, which I don't really understand that. I mean, yeah, I get kids are fucking assholes. I used to say mean things. Everyone does. But I don't get why you would make fun of someone for being adopted. When I was a kid, we called people, you know, smelly, stupid, butt face, you know, mean things, not adopted. I didn't know that was an insult, but apparently for children in South Africa, it is. Stuart also said that while the other children were teasing him, The teacher did nothing to stop them. He said the teacher actually incited the other students to tease him further, which if that's true, that's super fucked up. You are the teacher, you're supposed to be the adult. Whether or not the teacher incited the other students or not, Stuart's reaction we'll say a bit too much, okay? The next day, he came in and decided to assault the teacher, you know, as you do. So the principal stepped in and severely beat Stuart in front of the other students. Now, understand he needed to be punished for assaulting the teacher, like that's, you can't do that. But beating him in front of the other students? I don't think that was very smart either, though. And honestly, if you look at Stuart's past before this, it's easy to see why he would have assaulted the teacher. At this point, assault is really kind of the only thing he knows. You know, if dup, that's how people treat one another. Now, again, I'm not making excuses for adult Stuart who had choices and chose to murder people. I am kind of making excuses for child Stuart who really has no control or choices and keeps getting beaten down. Just so we're clear. Stuart was also a biter. He would often bite his mother and other children. Mrs. Wilkin punished him for this by locking him in his room. He also claimed that she would sometimes lock him in a cupboard. He was also punished for wetting the bed. Just like Donato, that Italian serial killer we covered a couple episodes ago. So the Wilkins were obviously much, much better than Dup. But they weren't Mike and Carol Brady either, okay? I mean, locking kids in cupboards, probably not the best. Once a boy at school attacked him, so he fought back. He was sent home for fighting, and Mrs. Wilkin punished him instead of taking his side as he felt she should have. So it was at this point that Stuart said he would be his own mother, father, sister, and auntie. He started smoking marijuana when he was 8 years old. 8-year-olds smoking marijuana. You want to smoke marijuana, go right the fuck ahead. Nobody cares. But I'm going to say it right now. 8-year-olds should not be smoking marijuana. 8-year-olds shouldn't be smoking anything. Except maybe those candy cigarettes. I don't know if they have those in South Africa, but that's the only thing little children should be smoking, okay? Mr. Wilkin unfortunately died when Stuart was 9, so now it's just Stuart and his mother. That same year, a deacon invited Stuart over after Sunday school. The deacon then sodomized 9-year-old Stuart. So once again, this child is being abused. And this particular abuse played a big part in his future crimes. He later said in his confession that he often thought about the deacon when he was with the boys he murdered. Now, his poor mother was overwhelmed by him and didn't know what to do with him, which, I mean, I totally get that. Like, this poor kid needed some serious counseling for everything he'd been through, and she just did not feel capable to give him the kind of care he needed, which I wouldn't know what to do with a child like this either. So, you know, at least she's admitting she needs some help. So she sent him to a reform school. Things did not improve for Stuart at reform school. As punishment at the school, he was sometimes locked up without clothes, because that just makes logical punishment sense. Sure. As punishment at the reform school, he was sometimes locked up without clothes, because, you know, that's a logical punishment. He also said that he was sodomized by the older boys at the reform school. He ran away from the reform school and went to live with his aunt. She let him stay for a month, but eventually she was like, yeah, you gotta go. I get it, you know, I'm sure it was a lot to have to handle this child who was suffering all these untreated psychological issues. That sounds like a real nice lady. I mean, she let him stay for a month. Then she said, you gotta go back to your mom's. She gave him food and bus fare. And I mean, she didn't have to do any of that. She could have just been like, get the fuck out. Now, since he was technically on the run from this state school, he actually had to appear in court when he ended up back at his mother's. And the court could have sent him back to the reform school. They didn't. Instead, the court said that as long as Stewart finished Standard 9, which is basically grade 11 here in America, he didn't need to be under the court's supervision anymore. So he finished grade 11, and that was the end of his scholastic career. After school, Stewart enlisted in the Army. Unfortunately, he was actually kicked out of the Army after only 4 months because he tried to commit suicide. So he moved back in with his mom, who is now living in Dispatch, which is near PE. At this point, he got an apprenticeship as a joiner. Now, I did have to look up what a joiner was because I wasn't sure. A joiner is kind of like a carpenter, but they join pieces of wood together in like kind of fancier ways, sort of artistic, a little nicer than just say a carpenter. Like a carpenter would do framing and shit for your house. A joiner wouldn't do that. So a joiner, it's like wood, but make it fancy. I'm sure Stewart was making good money doing this too, because that sounds like a very technical trade, like a craftsman type deal that I'm sure a lot of people could not do. Unfortunately, Stewart injured his hand on the job and could no longer work, so he started receiving disability. Maybe if he'd been able to keep this job, he wouldn't have murdered people. Like, maybe the job would have kept him busy. I don't know. Kind of feel like he would have killed anyway, but maybe not if work had kept him busy. We'll never know. In 1984, Stewart met a woman named Lynn at a nightclub. They really hit it off. When him and Lynn got together, Lynn already had a daughter from a previous relationship. I never saw anything that said what the daughter's name was, but Lynn does have a daughter at this point. Then on December 25th, 1985, so Christmas Day, Stewart and Lynn had a daughter who they named 1A. This is when their relationship took a turn, and not for the better. Lynn stated that after 1A's birth, Stewart would only have anal sex with her, which, hey, if that's what you like to do, you do you. I'm not kink-shaming anybody, or whatever you like to do in the bedroom is your business. One thing I will say, though, is if you want to do anal or whatever you want to do, everyone needs to be into it. Like, it needs to be consensual for everyone involved. And it kind of doesn't seem like Lynn was very into this, because she said he only wanted to do anal in very uncomfortable positions. Now, I know some people like a little pain, but she said uncomfortable, so I don't think she was into it. And like I said, little PSA, everyone involved in whatever sex is going on needs to be enjoying it, or else it's fucked up. So they're having some sex marriage type issues. Stewart actually alleged that Lynn turned to prostitution after their daughter was born. I didn't find anything saying that she was, so I don't know, but that's what's going on in the house. He's calling her a prostitute and making her have uncomfortable sex. Things got so bad in the house that the Department of Welfare was actually called on them, and the department actually threatened to remove Lynn's older daughter from the home. So, despite this drama and tension and such that's going on, they actually got married when 1A was 5, so around 1990. They got married because the court thought that them being married would provide a better home life for Lynn's older daughter. I'm just here to say that doesn't seem right. If your relationship is already having issues, marriage will not fix them. That's not what marriage is for, okay? So, of course, to no one's surprise, the marriage was not a happy one. Oh, they seem to be doing so well. Stewart apparently assaulted Lynn on multiple occasions, and she frequently had him arrested for smoking marijuana. Because remember, he started doing that when he was 8. He's still doing it, and it's illegal in South Africa at this time. He was eventually admitted to a psychiatric hospital. In the psychiatric hospital, he was diagnosed with psychopathy. So, you know, psychopath. How accurate was this diagnosis? I mean, yeah, he does some horrible fucking shit with no remorse. But later, psychologists studied him, and none have ever said anything about him being a psychopath. So who knows if he was or wasn't. At the end of the day, this really seems like a case where if this guy's abuse and trauma had been addressed and treated, maybe things would have turned out differently. Let me be clear, I'm not excusing his behavior. There are plenty of abused people who do not become serial killers. I just think that some of the early abuse definitely played a role in the things he ends up doing. You know, he's basically self-medicating with drugs and violence. Unfortunately, his stay in the hospital was short because they diagnosed him with psychopathy and there's no treatment for that, so they let him go. So he gets out of the psychiatric hospital and goes home, but Lynn won't let him in. She's like, no, bye. And honestly, I say good for her. This guy's an adult now, clearly needs some kind of help that he's choosing not to get. Plus, don't forget, she has 2 kids. She doesn't want this shit around her children. You'd prioritize your kids over some man, some woman, anything. Let it be a little lesson for everyone listening. No dick, vagina, whatever you're into will ever be more important than your children, okay? Just remember that. So not only did Lynn not let him in the house, she called the cops on him. Because I guess he was just chilling in her driveway like a fucking creep. He's like, dude, take a hint. She told you to leave. Fucking leave. So she calls the cops, because get off my lawn. And when Stuart saw the police cars, he attempted suicide by swallowing a whole bunch of pills. So he gets sent back to the psychiatric hospital. While I was in the hospital, Lynn filed for divorce. Cue in sync. Bye, bye, bye. After the divorce, Stuart swore he would never have sex with another white woman again because he was scared that they might be his long-lost sister. I love that he's worried about incest, but murder, pedophilia, and necrophilia are all okay. Sir, I think it is time to reevaluate all of your standards. At the time of their divorce, Stuart had a secret. When Stuart and Lynn divorced, Stuart had already murdered 5 people. Dun, dun, dun. We'll talk about them in a second, so just hold on tight. Lynn remarried, and Wane obviously lived with her mother and new stepfather. Stuart visited Wane often, and by all accounts, had a good relationship with his daughter. He did not have a good relationship with her new stepfather, though. The two of them would often get into violent fights when Stuart would come to see Wane. As a kid whose parents once got into a pretty intense kind of violent fight in front of her, let me just say, don't let your kids see that shit. It fucks them up, all right? So Stuart often visited Wane out on the sidewalk to avoid her father, her stepfather. That sidewalk will be the last place she has ever seen alive. Now, even though Stuart got that disability money, he got a job on a fishing boat. He supposedly enjoyed the work, but his bad attitude and creepy violent behavior quickly lost him the job. I'm just picturing the fisherman from that show Deadliest Catch, and then I'm imagining Stuart trying to cop some kind of attitude or something with them, and I'm imagining them beating him with a giant salmon. I'm not sure that happened, but how great would it be if it did? In fact, if nobody has beat him with a giant fish, I volunteer. Like, I will go to South Africa and beat him with a giant fish because fuck this asshole. So now we're back up just a little bit. Remember I told you that at the time of the divorce, he'd already murdered 5 people? We gonna talk about him. It's likely, before we get too far into the murders, I want to let you know that it's likely he killed more than the people that have been positively attributed to him. I mean, he claims he has, and most people think he did. But the first confirmed murder of his occurred in February of 1990. February 1990 was also around the time he married Lynn. So, you know, what do you do for your bachelor party? Some guys go to dinner, maybe see some strippers. No, not Stuart. He wanted to really party. So he picked up 15-year-old Monty Fico. Monty Fico was a street child, which is what they call homeless children in South Africa. And just so you know, there are a lot of street children in South Africa, and it's very sad. So Stuart picked up this 15-year-old Monty Fico, and he took him to Sillier's Secondary School, where he sodomized and strangled the boy. On October 3rd, 1990, Lynn and Stuart had an argument, so he left. And here again is another instance where Stuart sets himself apart from other guys. Most people would, gone for a drive, maybe stopped somewhere for a drink to cool off. But Stuart, nah, he no basic bitch, okay? Stuart went out and picked up a prostitute. He picked up 25-year-old Virginia Giesman. He paid her for sex and drove her to Dog Creek Primary School. He's got something against schools, probably because of all the horrible times he had in school. So him and Virginia have sex, vaginal sex. Then he started having anal sex with her. She complained, he probably didn't pay for that shit, and she might not have done that. Just because someone is a sex worker does not mean they are into everything. So when she complained, Stuart strangled her with her own clothing. He said he ejaculated as she died. And you're going to see that with him. This guy gets off on people dying and death and just fucked up shit. Dying and death, that is a kink I will shame. He actually later described how he would get off on watching his victims as he strangled them. He said that their lips would swell and their eyes would begin to protrude. When this was happening, that's when he would orgasm. He even had a fun name for what happened while he was strangling them. He called it the jelly bean effect. If I didn't already hate jelly beans, that would make me never want to eat them. He left Virginia's body in the schoolyard. So far, he's killed a male child and now an adult female. And we're going to see that with this case. Stuart really has two separate victim profiles, which is pretty rare for serial killers. Most serial killers target one specific type of victim, but Stuart targets both adolescent boys and female prostitutes. This is probably part of the reason police didn't even know there was a serial killer at the time, because they hadn't connected all the crimes. Also, I couldn't find anything definitive. But since Stuart swore he would never have sex with another white woman after he divorced Lynn, I'm assuming all the prostitutes he killed were either Indian, mixed race, or black. And like I said at the beginning, this is still apartheid, and non-whites are treated like absolute shit. So it's also likely that their deaths weren't investigated as much as they would have been if they'd been white. Another interesting thing to note about Stuart and these prostitutes is his attitude toward prostitution. Stuart later said that he believed sex was just something that everyone had a right to, and selling it was wrong. He actually said that the prostitutes were stealing by charging people for sex when sex was a right that no one should have to pay for or have the right to refuse. I got a couple of things to say about that. One, nobody has a right to sex with anybody. That is some of the rapiest shit I've ever heard. Two, he says it's wrong to pay for sex, yet he pays most of these people for sex before he kills them. So it's okay to pay as long as you're going to kill them and take your money back? Like, aren't you then stealing too? Or are you telling yourself it was a loan? Like, I don't understand this guy at all, but I guess it's because I'm not a psycho. On January 10th, 1991, Wilkin killed his third victim. He picked up 37-year-old Mercia Poppenfuss. She was a prostitute soliciting clients at the Red Lion Hotel. Stuart took her to St. George's Park. At the park, Mercia said she wanted the money up front. I say, good for her. I've never had any interactions with prostitutes, but I just assumed they all got their money up front. To me, that's just smart business. I think she got her money up front in Pretty Woman. That kind of tells you all you need to know about me, that my only reference point for prostitutes is Pretty Woman. Anyway, when she asked for the money up front, Stuart got fucking pissed. Because remember, he thinks you're stealing if you're selling sex anyway. He's pissed, so naturally, he strangles her. And then he did something new with this victim. After he strangled her to death, he was so excited by the jelly bean effect that he sodomized her dead body. That's right. We've now entered the necrophilia portion of our program. After this murder, Stuart started hiding the bodies a bit better. Not because he was scared of getting caught. Oh, no, no. He hid them so he could return to the bodies and have more sex with them. He even would stuff newspapers in their anuses so they wouldn't get infected with maggots or other bugs. He's having sex with dead bodies, but he does have some standards, guys. No maggots on his dick. He didn't hide Mercia's body, though, because, like I said, that's what he starts doing after this one. So when he was done having sex with her corpse, he just left her body in the park. Stuart took a little break after this. He killed Mercia in January, and he doesn't kill again until October. Not sure why he took a break, but I imagine some family drama had to do with it, because remember, at this point, he's still married to Lynn. So on October 21st, 1991, Stuart picked up a 14-year-old boy. This boy, unfortunately, was never identified. There were actually a few of his victims that are still unidentified, which is just awful. But that's why he targeted these homeless children, because he thought nobody would miss them. So he picks up this boy and they go to St. George's Park to have sex. The boy, like Mercia, was like, give me my money. Of course, this pissed Stuart off again because, you know, you're stealing. And so he was like, you know, fuck off, I'm not paying you. So this kid dips. He's like, cool, only came for the cash. He tried to leave. Stuart chased him, overpowered him. I mean, of course he did. Stuart's a grown-ass man, and this was a little boy. So he overpowered him. He sodomized him as he strangled him. As usual, he ejaculated as he strangled the boy. Want to know the most messed up part about this? I know, it's already messed up. But Stuart hid this body and would often return to it to have sex. The body wasn't discovered for 2 years. Stuart could have been having sex with this dead boy for 2 whole years. Ew. Honestly, ew doesn't cover it, but it's as close as I can get to what I want to say. In the summer of 1993, Stuart solicited another homeless child. This victim is also, unfortunately, unidentified. Like the previous victim, Stuart sodomized and strangled the boy and got off on it because he's a big piece of shit. He then hid this body in a ravine so he could revisit it for sex. And this brings us to the point of his divorce from Lynn. Lynn definitely dodged a bullet with this divorce. Whew. So Stuart takes another little break from killing. He killed that poor homeless boy in 93. We don't have a confirmed kill again until 95. Maybe he was killing in this time and they're just not connected to him. Or he didn't have time, because guess what Stuart was doing for those 2 years? Stuart was getting remarried. Stuart met a mixed woman named Veronica. He met and married her. At first, when I was researching this, I was like, why would someone marry this asshat? But then I remembered that no one knows what he's been doing at this point. So she meets him and she just thinks he's a nice, normal guy. Veronica had 2 sons from previous relationships. Unfortunately for them, this marriage didn't go any better than the first one. You know, probably because he was out raping and murdering people. But what do I know? I'm not married. Doesn't seem like good husband material to me. Maybe that's why I'm single. My standards are too high. I want somebody who doesn't murder people. It also didn't help their marriage that Veronica's family hated him. Like, from the moment they laid eyes on him, couldn't stand him. Normally, I'd be like, wow, way to quickly judge someone. But in this case, I'm like, yeah, he sucks. Good instincts on that. So Stuart's married, new family, happy, 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 right? No, he's got to go murder. That's the only way he gets happy. So on July 27th, 1995, Stewart picked up 42-year-old prostitute Georgina Sweeney. He took her to Prince Alfred Park, sodomized, and strangled her. Now this next part, I'm gonna get graphic. Just warning you. After he had strangled her, Stewart said he was still very aroused because, you know, nothing hotter than a corpse. Poor Stewart was unable to maintain another erection, though, so instead, he stuck a knife into her vagina repeatedly. He also cut her open, with the forensic pathologist stating at trial that there were 20 stab wounds on the body with a cluster of 5 around the navel. The forensic pathologist said it was a wild knife stabbing. The stabbing created sexual release for Stewart, and then he cut off Georgina's nipples and ate them like they were sashimi. I'm about to get very disgusting here for a moment, so if you don't want to hear that, skip ahead a bit. I don't understand why you would eat someone's nipples. To be clear, I don't understand why you would eat any part of a person, but I just don't get why nips would be your first pick. Like, that seems like there wouldn't be anything there. Also, is human flesh safe to be consumed raw? Again, I'm not a cannibal, just to be clear. But I feel like every story you hear about cannibals, they usually cook the people first. Stewart did actually say later, though, that he wished he would have cooked them. So, I don't know. I just, the whole thing makes me want to barf. So after his snack, he removed Georgina's clothes and threw them in a pond. Now, why did he dump the clothes this time? Well, Stewart had been watching the police, and the police have been finding these bodies. They haven't connected them all yet, but they're starting to find bodies. And like I said, Stewart's no dummy. So he realized he was probably leaving evidence on his victim's clothes, and he didn't want the police to link him to the bodies, so that's why he started getting rid of the clothes. Now, he's been so busy, you know, murdering people, that he hasn't had much time to devote to his new marriage. You know, work-life balance is hard, I get it. So they're not working out at home, so Stewart leaves and actually begins living in a field, you know, as one does. Why pay for an apartment when there are plenty of fields? Like I said, he's not like normal guys. He chose to live in a field near Happy Valley. Right away, I know Happy Valley is going to have something to do with children, and I don't want Stewart anywhere near it. Happy Valley is like a park kind of playground area thing. Has all these statues and figures of different children's characters and fairy creatures, that sort of thing. People were calling it magical and beautiful. I looked at some pictures of this place and it looked creepy, but that's just me. Stewart had apparently gone to Happy Valley as a kid with his mom, and he had happy memories there. I'm amazed he has any happy memories from his childhood, but cool. Now, if this guy wasn't a pedophilic murdering rapist, I'd say, cool man, do you, go live in a field. But when you know what this guy is doing to young boys, the fact that he is near a place frequented by children is nasty. The field also had a nice view of the water, which he liked, because remember, he used to be a fisherman, and I guess he liked the water. There were also pine trees nearby. I mean, honestly, this field sounds kind of nice, and I'm pretty pissed that this guy got to be there, because he doesn't deserve a nice field. Well, guess what the pines are good for, other than looking pretty? Any guesses? The pines are a great place to hide dead bodies. And Stewart would be the one to ask. The next murder is, in most people's opinions, the most fucked up out of all of them, just because of who the victim is. On September 29th, 1995, Stewart visited his daughter, Wanae. Wanae's half-sister saw Stewart and Wanae on the sidewalk in front of the house. Because remember, him and stepdaddy don't get along, so they usually sat outside on the sidewalk. Wanae was never seen again. According to Stewart, he was concerned about Wanae because she told him that her stepfather was molesting her and there was no food at home. Her sister did say there were times when there was little food and their stepdad didn't like them, but she never said anything about the stepfather molesting them. Now, sure, he could have been molesting Wanae without the sister knowing, or the more probable explanation is that he just needed an excuse to kill his kid. Stewart said that Wanae wanted to run away, so he took her to Happy Valley. Once at Happy Valley, Stewart decided that he needed to inspect Wanae's vagina. Remember, She is a child, a little girl. No grown-ass man should ever be inspecting a little girl's vagina unless it's in a clinical setting. And even then, there better be a damn good reason for it. His inspection revealed that she was no longer a virgin. Stuart wanted to save her from the kind of life he had lived, so he did what any good parent would do in this situation. He strangled her. He said he was, quote, sending her soul to God. So this guy is worried he might accidentally sleep with his sister, but playing doctor and murdering his daughter is fine. If you think someone is molesting your daughter, why wouldn't you call the police? Or, and I'm not encouraging vigilante shit, but if you did feel the need to take matters into your own hands, why wouldn't you murder the molester? I'm truly baffled by the fact that this man killed his own daughter. Everyone said they had a good relationship and he was good to her. How does one go from good dad to sicko murderer? This one is also odd because Wanae doesn't match any of his other victims. Every other murder is either a young boy or a female prostitute. She's the only little girl he ever killed, as far as we know. Stuart removed Wanae's clothes and then he kept her body. He would talk to the body and sleep next to it every night. He did this until the body had decomposed into a skeleton. Do you know how long it takes for a body to turn into a skeleton? I googled it and there's a lot of factors such as climate, but minimum is a few weeks. So he was just sleeping next to his daughter's rotting corpse for weeks. Meanwhile, people are looking for her because she's a missing child. I'm going to post a photo of a newspaper article looking for her. And the whole time he just had her rotting corpse. Police found her skeleton almost 8 months after she went missing on May 22nd, 1996. They found the skeleton under a tarp behind a Garden Court Holiday Inn. Unfortunately for her family, the skeleton remained unidentified until Stuart confessed years later. The skeleton was so decomposed, all the police could tell was that it was a Caucasian girl under the age of 12. Now, even though he got rid of the skeleton, he kept her clothes. He shaped them into kind of a body, and he would lay next to them and talk to them like she was still there. It's like some reverse Norman Bates shit up in here. That's what this fucking is. Now, to this day, Stuart swears he never had sex with Wanae, either alive or dead. I find that hard to believe, but okay. Stuart was questioned about Wanae's disappearance after she went missing. He told the police they had visited on the sidewalk and then he had left. Now, of course, the cops didn't have any reason to suspect her father at the time. At this point, he's just an eccentric guy living in a field. Sure, he's had some issues, but he seems to be a decent dad. If he says he left, sounds right. On May 25th, 1996, only 3 days after the police found Wanae's skeleton, Stuart picked up another prostitute at the Albany Road Exchange. This prostitute was 22-year-old Katrina Clausen. They went to the beach to have sex. At the beach, Stuart shoved a plastic bag down her throat to keep her from screaming. My throat is closing up just thinking about that. Ew. He then sodomized and strangled her. He dumped her body under a wall with a graffiti message that said, "People shouldn't steal." He thought this was very funny because, remember, he thinks that prostitutes are stealing when they charge people for sex. So yeah, he dumped her there on purpose just so he could laugh about it. Somewhere between May and August of 1996, we don't know the exact date, Stuart met another homeless boy. This boy is also still to this day unidentified. He took this boy to Fort Frederick. The boy masturbated Stuart. Then Stuart made the boy undress, then he sodomized him. Stuart claimed he only strangled the boy because the boy threatened to tell the police. I think that's a fucking lie. We all know he was going to kill the boy no matter what. He hid the boy's body, presumably so he could continue to have sex with it. Now, Stuart is still married to Veronica at this point, and he would occasionally go home to her between living out in the field. In early 1997, though, Veronica's sons accused Stuart of sodomy. She took them to the police station and an investigation was opened against Stuart on charges of sodomizing his stepsons. This is when Stewart kind of goes cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. He flees the house, never goes back, and just lives in the woods with Juanes' clothes as company. He would come to town occasionally, I guess to get supplies or something, and he was known for wearing the same dirty shirt, jeans, and boots every day. People said he also had unkempt hair and a wild, bushy beard. Basically, he's just out here looking like a dirty butt muffin, which makes sense. There's no plumbing or laundry in fields. That's one of the downsides of living in a field, man. Because of his appearance, the locals called him Booty Boar. This translates as brother farmer, which, as you can imagine, they didn't mean in a nice way. They were making fun of him when they called him that. So now on Wednesday, January 22nd, 1997, 12-year-old Henry Bakers does not come home. His mom, Ellen Bakers, initially doesn't think much of this because Henry would often spend the night at his grandmother's, who lived nearby. Friday morning, however, he still hadn't come home, so Ellen's like, okay, I gotta go get him. She goes to her mother's house, and her mother tells her that Henry left for home on Wednesday. He'd been missing for 2 days at this point. A friend of Henry's said they had played on Wednesday at a park, but then his friend had to go buy milk for his parents, so he left. Later, the friend saw Henry with Stewart Wilkin. Everyone in the area knew who Booty Boar was. Also, Henry knew Stewart personally. A couple of sources said that Stewart had stayed at Henry's grandmother's home before, and a few said he'd stayed at Henry's house. Either way, Henry knew Stewart. So Henry's friend saw Henry walking with Stewart, whatever. Then they went past Henry's street. This friend is a perceptive fuck and was like, hold up, where are they going? Remember, kids, grown-ups that are not related to you have no reason to be going places with you, all right? The friend ran after them and asked where they were going. Before Henry could answer, Stewart told Henry's friend to mind his own business. Then he led Henry away. That was the last time Henry was ever seen. Stewart later claimed that Henry had asked him to teach him about sex. I'm sure he did. Stewart said he masturbated Henry. Then he made Henry, a 12-year-old child, perform oral sex on him. But that wasn't enough, so then he sodomized and strangled the boy. He said he ejaculated while Henry died. He hid the body so he could return to it and have sex. Well, once Henry's mom found out he was missing, she of course called the police. Henry's friend told the police about seeing Henry with Stewart. Of course, they start looking for Stewart since he was the last person to be seen alive with the victim. While they're looking for him, they also realized that there were two sodomy charges being investigated against him. Remember the stepsons? And they realized that his daughter had weirdly gone missing, just like this boy, and he'd been the last one seen with her, too. So all this shit's piling up and starting to look real bad for Stewart. But the police had a hard time finding him because he lives in a field. He has no permanent address. It's like real life, where's Waldo? They did find him, though, and he was arrested on January 28th, 1997. Of course, he was very concerned about missing Henry. He had seen the boy the day he went missing, but he didn't know what happened to him. He even had an alibi. He told the cops that he had spent the night with a lady friend, so the cops had to let him go. At this point, they have possible sodomy and two missing kids, but no real evidence. Yeah, weird-ass dude seems creepy and suspicious as fuck, but they can't prove anything right now. Well, the cops check his alibi, and as we already know, it was false. As always, I say, do these criminal dumb fucks not think the police will check their alibis? Stewart was rearrested on January 31st, 1997. After his arrest, a special detective was called in to help with the case. The detective was Sergeant Derek Norsworthy. This guy's fucking awesome, okay? He's the one that gets Stewart to spill his fucking guts. Sergeant Norsworthy had been trained by Mickey Pistorius. If you don't know who Mickey Pistorius is, go look her up. She's an awesome badass bitch. She's an expert psychological profiler. She's written all kinds of books about serial killers, taught people how to profile criminals all around the world. have a couple of quotes from her that I might use in a bit. But anyway, she's the fucking shit. And this Sergeant Norsworthy was trained by her, so clearly he knew what he was doing. This guy actually used a picture of his own daughter, who was about Wanae's age, to get Stuart to confess. He left Stuart in his office, making sure Stuart could see a picture of his daughter. When he came back, he told Stuart that he knew he killed the two children. Stuart didn't say anything. He just looked at him and said, "I'm sick." Oh, I just want to say, what a badass move to use your kid's picture for that. I don't know if I'd want that man looking at my kid's picture, but it worked out, so cool. Stuart then admitted that he had killed his daughter and Henry Baker's. In fact, Stuart told the sergeant that he had returned to Henry's decomposing corpse that very morning to have sex with it. Stuart claimed that Henry was being abused by his parents, and so like Wanae, he had killed him to save him and return his soul to God. Henry's parents denied ever having abused him, and I saw nothing to indicate otherwise. So yeah, Stuart just looking for an excuse to be a dick. Even with this confession, they still don't have any real evidence. Well, Stuart's like, "Here, you want some evidence?" And he tells them where the bodies are. This is when they finally learned that the skeleton they had found the previous year was Wanae's. Then he took them to Henry's body in Algoa Park. Henry's body was found infested with maggots. I'm going to post a photo of Stuart showing the cops something. I think it was when he was showing them where Henry's body was. Not positive, but it's him showing the cops something. And no matter what he's showing them, it's disturbing because you know what the fuck he was up to. Now, Sergeant Norsworthy is smart as fuck and good at his job. So he knew there was no way that Stuart had only killed these two kids. So he tells him, "I know there's more bodies." And Stuart just casually tells him, "Probably at least 10. Stuart then made a full confession to his lawyers. He explained all the crimes in explicit, foul detail. Police had discovered all the bodies already, but they hadn't connected them. So now they actually have to go back through all of these old files and connect them to Stuart. Stuart ended up being charged with 10 counts of murder. He would later claim that he murdered more people, but tossed their bodies out to sea. Psychologists who have examined him kind of agree with that. So who knows how many people this guy actually murdered. One gem from his confession that I found particularly disturbing was that he said he would rub the feet of the boys' corpses in butter and vinegar so the police dogs couldn't smell them. But this man failed grade 3 times. Like I said, he no dummy. How do you even think like that? If I knew police dogs were sniffing for something, I'd probably panic and jump out and surrender before they even found what they were looking for. This dude is conniving as fuck. He also admitted that he would scope out the murder spots beforehand. Again, just like Donato in Italy. So weird they're both alike. Stuart said, quote, "When I looked for a place, I knew what I was going to do there." So now this is when they call in Queen Bitch, Mickey Pistorius. Like I said before, she's a bad motherfucker. She basically pioneered profiling in South Africa, and she'd interviewed a bunch of other serial killers too, so they called her in to interview Stuart. She said Stuart was impulsive and clearly very sexually connected to these crimes. Now, she does not buy his story that he didn't have sex with Wanae, and I don't either. She said that even if he was with his daughter, if a sexual urge came over him, he wouldn't be able to stop himself from acting on it. In fact, while Stuart was telling her about his crimes, he has to be excused for the restroom. He told police on the way to the bathroom that he was going to masturbate. Talking about all the people he raped and murdered was just warming up the spank bank for him. Yuck. Pistorius doesn't believe that he has any remorse or bad feelings about anything he did. She said, quote, "Stuart Butibor Wilkin fits the classic profile of a serial killer and will murder again when the opportunity arises, whether he is in prison or outside." Stuart basically admits as much in a later interview. In 2006, he gave an interview where he said, quote, "I would strangle them while having sex. I would go into another world when I am strangling them and raping them. When I was strangling them, they would go limp, like a jellyfish. Made me feel like a king. I had sex with some of the dead bodies. Then I can have my ecstasy. Then I can do things the way I wanted to. There's no screaming and chaos. I would fantasize about the murders and masturbate at the body. Let's look at Stuart's motives a bit, shall we? We don't know for sure why he did what he did, but some psychologists have speculated. The young male victims are likely a projection of young Stuart. He may have actually thought he was saving them, as he claims. Or the one I personally agree with is that since he was a victim at such a young age, he now has to act as an aggressor. You know, in the beginning of his life, all he knew was abuse, and it makes sense that he would have internalized that. The first 6 years are some of the most important for psychological development, and obviously his were very lacking. As for the woman victims, these are a bit harder to understand. Some people think they were substitutes for his mother that abandoned him. Some think he targeted prostitutes because they were easy targets. He also seemed to have some kind of hatred for prostitutes, because remember, he accused his first wife of being one at one point. We'll probably never know the real reason behind his crimes. I think Stuart said it best when he said, "I'm sick." You can see how sick he is during the trial, too. The prosecution said he showed no emotion or anything during the trial, even as they described the crimes. There was only one moment during the trial where Stuart seemed uncomfortable, and that was when they brought Juan's skull in as evidence. At this point, Stuart asked for a break. Court was adjourned and he was led to a holding cell. Why do you think Stuart wanted a break? To cry? To mourn the loss of his child? Nope. Stuart asked for a break so he could masturbate. He masturbated after seeing his daughter's skull, but sure, he never had sex with her body. On February 23rd, 1998, Stuart Wilkin was found guilty of 7 counts of murder. Unfortunately, he was not found guilty of the 3 unidentified boys because there wasn't enough evidence. Interesting to note about South Africa, there's no jury trials. You just go before a judge. So this judge found him guilty, and the judge sentenced him to 7 life sentences. The judge's name was Chris Janssen, and he said that Stuart needed to be removed from the community. The judge also told him that if the death penalty were still around in South Africa, he would have imposed it. And you guys know I love a sassy judge. So snaps to Janssen. I can't snap my fingers, but you guys all do it and we'll be good. Stuart apparently burst into tears when the sentence was announced. Oh, boo fucking who. Feel bad for him at all. You don't get to murder 10 people, maybe more, and then cry when you're punished. Fuck you. During the investigation, Sergeant Nurseworthy actually tracked down Stuart's biological mother. She said that she didn't abandon him and she still loved him. I'm sorry. I know compared to him, she is a saint, but what the fuck? How is she going to leave her babies in a phone booth and say she didn't abandon them? She actually spoke to him on the phone once. On the phone with her, he cried and called her mommy. I almost feel bad for him until I remember he is a piece of shit. You know what's really messed up? His mother told him that she had reunited with his sister and she was alive and well. So not only did she abandon her kids in a phone booth, but then she came back and only took one of them. Cool. That's great parenting. Again, not an excuse for his behavior at all. I'm just letting you know where he's coming from. Stuart Wilkin is currently serving his sentence in St. Albans Prison. In the prison, he is apparently tormented by hallucinations and says that the ghosts of his victims haunt him. I hope they fucking do. Dr. Pistorius doesn't seem to think he is actually being haunted. She thinks because he can't play aggressor anymore, he has reverted back to being the victim. Either way, fuck that guy. May he forever rot in prison and then proceed to rot in hell. And that is finally going to bring us to the end of the case of Stuart Wilkin. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. We should be everywhere. You can follow the podcast on Instagram for case photos. I always post photos from each episode. The Instagram is Have Murder Will Travel. You can also find the podcast on Facebook. It's Have Murder Will Travel Podcast. You can send me an email anytime you want. It's havemurderwilltravel@gmail.com. Tune in next week to find out where we travel next. Until then, don't forget to explore the world and stay alive. Bye.